Hello, Radioland, Podcastville, and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books. On today's show, Catherine Taylor is here to tell us about her new novel, Valley Fever. She also wrote a piece for LARB called How Vivian Gornick Saved My Life, and we'll be talking to her about that. Antoine Wilson, the author of the novels Panorama City and The Interloper, has dropped in. He's here to help us bury John Barth.
Which I should say, John Barth is still alive, so that's not right.
Gary Phillips is going to shame me about what I haven't read. And BJ Novak was scheduled to be on the show last week, but our segment on alternate side of the street parking in Los Feliz ran long, and we had to bump him once again. He's graciously consented to return, and we are looking forward to finally catching up with him. I don't know why. Lori, why did we go so long on parking?
It's important. It's a local issue.
All right. You're right. That's true. And this is a Los Angeles-based show. Joining me are my usual unindicted co-conspirators, the professor, the founder of LARB, blues musician, author, bicycle enthusiast, Tom Lutz. Hello, Tom.
One of those things is not true. Bonjour.
And editrix, writer, journalist, Hammerstein aficionado, Nazi hater. She doesn't just hate Nazis. She hates Nazis a little more than the rest of us do.
I love Nazis.
But that's why. I think it's a very complicated thing.
Yeah, it's love and hate. It's that part where they intersect in the extreme.
Lori?
Nice to see you.
Catherine Taylor is with us, the novelist Catherine Taylor. Her first book was called Rules for Saying Goodbye. Her new novel is Valley Fever. And Catherine, welcome.
Thank you.
I want to talk to you about a piece you wrote for LARB, a very popular piece called How Vivian Gornick Saved My Life. And it's a review, but it's not a review.
I wanted to write about that book. It was a book I'd been obsessed with since I got it in February, I think. And I contacted you kind people at LARB, and the review had already been assigned. I said, well, I didn't want to write a review. I wanted to write, it's a very personal book, and I wanted to write my very personal response to this memoir. And also, I just don't think I'm suited to writing reviews. And the editor was,
Dinah Lenny.
Yes, was really responsive and excited. And so I began writing this review and really, really struggled with it. All I wanted to say essentially was, I really loved this book. It really spoke to me at a time that I needed to be spoken to. The review was not working out. And I spoke to a friend of mine who suggested that I really needed to write about what was happening in my life while I was reading that book and why it affected me the way it did.
Oh, and it was a real popular piece on our website. People loved it. It was on the top 10 most read list for a long, long time. I think at LA Review of Books, we do have a dissatisfaction with the normal kind of review. One of the things that Tom sometimes says at fundraising parties, which he probably shouldn't say, is that
Let's say it on the air. Then.
Okay, that's what I thought. Yeah. When all the newspaper book review sections started to die, which everyone bemoaned and we bemoaned, and that was one of the reasons that he started LARB. But you know what? Those 800-word reviews really weren't that great,
right?
And they'd leave a lot to be desired. So we try to do something different with much longer pieces, but also with coming at this kind of angle that you found. Why did you feel like you didn't want to write a review of the Vivian Gornick?
I just don't think I'm suited to writing reviews. I wouldn't ever want to publish a bad review. As a writer, I wouldn't ever want to publish a bad review of someone else's work. And so that seems kind of disingenuous to only have written positive reviews. It's not something I'm built for.
We run into this problem all the time, which is that people who don't want to write bad reviews don't even want to say, I'll read it and decide.
Right.
Because they don't want to be in the position of having turned down the opportunity of doing the review.
Right. When you have a book that's just sort of been birthed into the world, the whole idea of reviews and speaking about reviews is very touchy.
So yeah,
I'm thinking,
right.
Like, you're personally, having a little panic attack right now? I'm like, you know, I don't think I want to speak about
it. Let's get back to Vivian Gornick herself.
Right.
Vivian Gornick, what was so resonant in Vivian Gornick to you that you felt you needed to write that deeply personal response?
Well, it's so rare that I am excited by a book the way I was excited by that book. And I'm familiar with her work. I wrote in the essay about how in the, I think it was 2001, I went to Breadloaf. And she was there, and I was a tiny thing, and I was a contributor, and no one pays attention to the contributors. You're really like the vermin.
I love the way you describe the hierarchy at Breadloaf.
It was not the greatest experience for me when I was 20. I can't remember how old I was, 20-something years old. But obviously, the only person having a worse time than I was at Breadloaf was Vivian Gornick, and she made no secret of it. And I didn't know who she was at the time. I got back to New York, where I was living, and and immediately looked up everything she had written. And I always appreciated her work. Nothing has ever made me as excited as that book did, not just of her work, but I'm rarely as excited about a book as I was about that one, which is why I wanted to write about it. Who wants to write about a book you don't care about that much? I really cared about this book, but I've always identified with Vivian Gornick because she notices what's wrong in the world and she gets upset about it.
And now to get to the book, to the Valley Fever, the first line of the novel is, "I don't return to places I've lived." But in fact, you did.
Well, that's funny because the protagonist does in fact go home in the novel. So.
And you go home in the Vivian Gornick essay as well.
Yes. Well, that's a theme of my own life. Since I moved out of New York, I haven't returned to the neighborhood where I lived. One time I walked past the building on accident. I was going somewhere and I had to walk past the building and I walked so fast and I could feel myself beginning to hyperventilate. That line, I had been rereading Breakfast at Tiffany's. And at the very beginning of Breakfast at Tiffany's, he says, it's something along the lines of, I'm always drawn back to places where I've lived. And I stopped and thought, I've never felt anything like that. What kind of person is drawn back to the places where they've lived? I just want to avoid them.
Yeah.
There's always a reason that you left.
Exactly.
And I want to avoid the reasons that I left.
I keep running.
Your novel, Valley Fever, is set in the location where you grew up, which is Fresno Valley and the wine country. And it's just drenched in the details of wine growing. And you know, you obviously know it so well.
And no, you're not from a family of farmers. You obviously had to do a lot of research because it's a very technical thing. And that stuff is in the book. Talk about that process. And are you a writer who ordinarily does research? Because I personally abhor leaving my desk.
I try as hard as I can to set up my life so I don't have to leave the house. And I like to do research, but I'm interested in tennis and college football and things like this, which I tried to sort of shoehorn into the book and then eventually had to cut out because that's the reading I can do from home.
Let me ask you a technical inside baseball writer's question. At what point did you say to yourself, you know, I can't just do this on the internet?
I need to leave the house.
Yeah. Because that must have been your first instinct, right?
I wasn't the person who said that to myself. I had given up on the book. This was about 2009, 2010. I'd given up on the book. I phoned my editor and told her, this is the book that we lose. This is the one we have to throw out. And she was not having it. And she had been telling me this for a long time, and I couldn't interpret exactly what she was saying, which was Ingrid, the protagonist, had been telling the story of what happened to her family and her family's farm. And my editor at the time, Courtney Hodell, said, you have to place Ingrid on the farm, which she had been saying for a long time. And I refused to hear because, as I told Courtney, I would have to do so much research. And she says, do your research. And I hung up the phone and I got in the car and I made phone calls on the way up to Fresno. I phoned my father and my father's golf buddies who are all farmers and some friend of my mother's in particular whose husband passed away, but who they were big farmers in the 80s. And these people were just incredibly generous with their time and they were so patient. And I rode around and for years I'd go up for the harvest. For 4 or 5 years I went up for the harvest and rode around with these farmers. And then the whole purpose of the book kind of, I mean, I had been writing this book since 2005 and it was stuck. It was dead. And when I just went up there and actually started learning about what it is farmers do every day, the book came alive again.
Did that change your relation to never wanting to leave the house now that you've...
No.
No. So we should apologize for dragging you out of the house for this interview.
Can you guys come to me next time?
We do house calls occasionally. My name is Seth Greenland. I am here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner. This is the LARB Radio Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM, and we are talking to author Catherine Taylor.
How does your family read you?
I'm not sure my father reads my books at all. He kind of pretends that he does, but then there are these little reveals where it becomes apparent that he doesn't really read anything that I write, which is fine. He doesn't read fiction. But I just am incredibly lucky to have this supportive and understanding family. So I can use all of their darkest sort of secrets and flaws, and they are extremely forgiving. And also I think sometimes they don't realize what I'm doing.
Didn't you have a friend who wrote a really nasty representation of his father, and his father's response was, I know guys exactly like
that. Oh, everybody has that story.
Yeah.
Sure. We all know that person. Yeah.
In my first book, the mother was, you know, I mean, flawed, but very lovable. and she was fat, and my mother is fat. And so my mother, and well, also the mother in my first book was called Elizabeth Taylor, and my mother is called Elizabeth Taylor. But and my mother clearly saw that mother as her.
I don't understand why just, that would
you
be.
You just didn't want to make a name up.
She's
You're
clearly
just feeling lazy that day.
I have to tell you.
She's clearly
Betty
a
Taylor
narcissist.
Wasn't going to work. Susan Taylor, it had to be Elizabeth Taylor.
You can't make a name up like Elizabeth Taylor.
No.
And also, by the way, the mother in the book was a toned down version of my mother. And in this book, the mother is a bit of a sinister character. She's not really a good guy, but I made her skinny.
She did.
My mother does not see herself in this character at all.
That's how you do it.
Yeah, right.
Well, John Ritchie says you can write anything you want about a person. You can say that they're a child molester as long as you say they're pretty.
Right.
They'll forgive you. So maybe skinny skinny,
that's right.
Pretty, whatever.
Do you feel that you came up with three other novels in the course of doing this novel? And is there more to write about Fresno, and are you going to go back into
I
that
never
world?
Know if I'm done with Fresno. I've been asked this question a bit, you know, and I don't know. I mean, I wrote about Fresno in my first book, peripherally, and this one is obviously really Fresno-centric, and there is something about that place I still feel very conflicted about. And if you feel conflicted about anything, right, it's always going to show up in your work. And this next book that I am going to have a draft done by the end of the year, it so far doesn't have Fresno in it. We'll see. We'll see what happens. I don't know how that's going to be possible, but it may be possible.
Catherine Taylor, the book is Valley Fever. Mystery writer Gary Phillips has found his way to our bunker today.
You have somebody you want to pitch to our listeners, a book or an author that you think they should be reading that you want to talk about?
Can I have one piece of blatant self-promotion?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course.
We welcome blatant
self-promotion. I have a short story in this crazy anthology called Something Strange is Going On. And I recommend it, one, because of course I wrote the short story, so I want you to read that. But it's actually all the characters in this anthology, it's a prose anthology, are actually based on this guy. There's a guy named Fletcher Hanks. And Fletcher Hanks was one of the pioneer is not quite the word, but he was one of the comics artists and writers working in the what they call the Golden Age, in other words, the beginning of what became modern comic books. So like from 1939 to 1941. Actually, there's a couple of books about Fletcher Hanks that collect his work, and his work is considered very primitive and strange. And he himself was a terrible human being. He was an alcoholic, abused his wife, stole his kids' money. And in classic, you know, Jim Thompson form, like I said, he burns hot and bright for like these 3 years in the beginning of the comic business. He mostly did work for an outfit called Fiction House. And he did Fantoma, who's arguably one of the first, she certainly predates Wonder Woman. She's one of the first female superheroes. He did Space Smith, which is, I'd use the Space Smith character in my story. Mo M. Down, how about that for a name, of course, and some other crazy characters. And he just wrote these really strange, weird stories. I can't even describe the stories to you, but suffice it to say there was always some quixotic and cruel ending his heroes would, Stardust was another one of his characters, would give to the villains. And so this guy named Jim Beard had an idea that because of all of Fletcher Hanks' characters have fallen in the public domain, he then gathered together a group of us to write stories based on his characters, but of course with the Hanksian zeitgeist in play. And so in my story, which is a Space Smith story, as I mentioned, I include in there something about the maggot brain and cosmic slop, and those Funkadelic fans out there will recognize what that
great
is.
Great reference.
Yeah.
Shout out to Eddie Hazel.
exactly. The late, great Eddie Hazel, exactly. So Something Strange is Going On, I just want to plug that book. Oh, and I should mention, I was saying, so in true sort of Jim Thompson-esque form, as I said, Hanks burns bright for like these 3 years. Like I say, he's a drunk, abuser, terrible person, disappears, just leaves his family, disappears. There's a few stories that maybe he did a few murals because he had some weird connection to some rich folks out on a lot on Long Island, so he maybe did some murals for them. And then he's gone. He's like, nobody hears from him again, what have you. So whatever he did for a living, who knows? And maybe he kept his hand in comics doing backgrounds and fill-in work, I don't know. And then like in the 70s, they find him because he's this busted-out old man who dies of exposure on a park bench one night. And so there you go. That's the Fletcher Hanks story. So what? So I'm sure...
That's a swell story.
It's a swell story. Somebody will do the Fletcher Hanks story for sure. But as I said, in that vein, the stories in Something Strange is Going On, tap tap that weird vibe that was Hank's.
Thank you for that inspirational tale, Gary.
That's right.
Kids write comics.
Kids write comics. So you too can wind up on a park bench, bust it out, and gone.
Nadie comprende lo que sufro yo. Canto, pues ya no puedo sollozar.
Antoine Wilson is with us now. He's the author of Panorama City and The Interloper. Welcome, Antoine.
Oh, hi. Thanks.
Tom, you asked Antoine to review a collection of John Barth stories. What happened?
He didn't do it.
Yeah. How do you feel about that?
I'm a little peeved, I have to admit.
Antoine, what do you have to say to Tom?
I'm sorry. I'm sort of a conscientious guy. So this was, I don't think I've ever done that before. I had been assigned a review and sort of had to write the little email as if I was writing to like my old lit prof or something.
And Tom, how does that make you feel hearing that?
Well, I'm glad that he's sorry.
I respect your authority.
Your authority.
Yeah.
Now, Antoine, are you a Barth guy? Are you in the Barth Club?
And I think that's one of the things that is Tom just tossed it over to me, and maybe he thought that I would be a Barth guy because I'm a smartass. But
a
wide reader of all different kinds of things, and David Foster Wallace fan. Stuff like that. But I, in fact, you know, had read maybe Night Sea Journey 20 years ago. And I just remembered I read the End of the Road in college, but I don't really remember things that I read back in college. Some people do. I was like a no taste guy. I was still, very much a zygote back then. So I was going to look at this as sort of, I'm old enough and young enough to be sort of just from the lit generation right after the one where Barth might be de rigueur. So I thought, what's the sort of next generation thinking about John Barth and coming to it fresh? But I kind of had to backpedal a little bit.
And it's because you just were not happy enough with what you were reading. I mean, that's frankly what happened, right? And you didn't want to write a negative review.
Yeah, and I feel like there are other people out there who will write negative reviews, and I'm not totally opposed to negative reviews, but I also don't feel like Barth's stature right now is sort of high enough or prominent enough that he deserves any kind of takedown. He's not, you know, like if you want to take down somebody, take down Jonathan Franzen or something, you know.
So Barth was very popular in the university system in the late 70s. Is that correct?
In the 70s.
Yeah.
And I read him. I loved Giles Goatboy, The End of the Road, I thought was, you know, I loved half of that. And a number of the novels I was very wowed by in the 70s. And he is one of those guys whose star has dimmed over the years. And that makes, I thought it would be interesting to have a conversation about why he won out of favor.
Would you say he's no longer canonical?
I don't know a single person who teaches John Barth in a literature
really
course
amazing.
In the university system.
Yeah. Because everyone
it's
taught
possible.
Him.
I mean, yeah. But he's fallen out of it.
Well, something that's interesting about this collection is that he saw all of his short story collections as books. So he conceptualized each individual one almost as a coherent work of art. So there's Lost in the Funhouse, and then the other collections, and they don't come until years later. So it doesn't feel sort of like a collected or a selected so much as, you know, four books squished together in a large volume.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, the story Lost in the Funhouse itself is actually a really... It holds up. It is a fantastic short story, mm-hmm. as is, there's one called Water Message, which I think is also remarkable. And you get the sense, though, with a lot of the other ones that you're reading historically, you're sort of reading it like, okay, this was an experiment at that time in response to something that isn't necessarily dominant anymore. And so, you know, he's smashing some idols and they haven't been idols for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and of course, an experiment, you only call something experimental if it doesn't work.
I think it would be helpful if one of you could just talk about what his style is or what one of the short stories is about and what the style of it is, because I'm sure a lot of listeners have not read him.
Well, The Sotweed Factor is a book that's written as an 18th century novel. It's mimicking the style of the 18th century. And so it's literary historical jokes in all sorts of ways.
Yeah. And in the stories, there are some of these jokes, but a lot of the time it feels as though in the same way that it feels like an in-joke married to a certain kind of low-level intellectual lit snobbery. So it's like, oh, you're in on this, aren't you? I'm in on this. And it's not really that funny. Like, I want jokes that are funny. I read Mason and Dixon, the Thomas Pynchon novel that's written in, I think, an 18th century voice, and it is awesome. I mean, it's long, and sometimes it's a bit of a slog, but it's consistently preposterous and funny. And I just felt like a lot of the time, especially with the Barth, when he got into the later stories, everything kind of sagged a little bit.
And literary gamesmanship, which was a part of the 70s ethos, this postmodern ethos, and which Pynchon was a master of.
Sure.
It always failed if it didn't have something else going on.
Yes. And with Barth, I felt like, I mentioned Lost in the Funhouse and Water Message, they're in that first collection, all the stories sort of revolve around this main character, Ambrose, who's an adolescent. And there's a strain of sort of identity-seeking, adolescent angst, yearning, pubescent whatnot that really gives it some background and some weight. But when those things don't seem to grow, and like the insight that's applied to those isn't quite happening in the Elderly Residents of the Development, his last collection, it just sort of feels like there are a bunch of archetypes walking around or caricatures.
You're listening to the LARB Radio Hour. I'm Seth Greenland, here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, and we are talking to novelist Antoine Wilson on KPFK 90.7 FM.
Did you read Barth as an undergraduate?
Just The Night Sea Journey, which is the story told from the point of view of a winning spermatozoan, spermatozoan. You know what I mean. And
sperm.
Sure. Well, yeah, what's the singular of jizz? Gin. I read the End of the Road, but I don't remember it.
So in your rereading of Barth, did you apprehend your younger self differently at all?
That's an interesting question.
Thank you.
You're unlike welcome. All the other questions.
Yeah, so that's the first interesting question
I've
heard all
over
day.
Here.
I was probably much more postmodernly inclined as an undergrad with my first stories, and my first attempt at a novel did have a sort of overarching young man in search of his father who had supposedly died, but then evidence had turned up that he may have been still alive and well in Europe. But there was also this sort of conceptual overarching thing that this young man was a spermatozoan, a jizz. and that the last line of the book was going to be him, sitting in a diner outside the Vatican and cracking open an egg, you know? So like, I was interested in that kind of stuff. I had a head full of Pynchon and no creative writing, quote unquote, education. And that kind of stuff did appeal to me more. And the idea of the funhouse, the mirrors refracting other things. And I think I continued to be interested in Pynchon. And then also I really got into Vladimir Nabokov, and I read pretty much everything he wrote. That was a bit later on, and I feel like maybe a more mature somehow version of postmodernism, because he brings it. He brings the feeling of what it is to be alive. Mm.
Do you like Pale Fire?
Yes, it is. I think Pale Fire is one of the funniest books I've ever read, except you won't laugh out loud. It's funny, like way up in the front of your head.
Now, do you like Panin? I'm leading up to another question.
Panin, I thought... Yeah, I thought it was okay.
Make the argument that Pale Fire is better than Panin, because I completely disagree.
I don't know if I have an argument to be made.
The Nabokovians are all leaning forward
yes,
now.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Panin has Fist no footnotes. Come on. Footnotes are funny.
Yeah, I wouldn't even argue Pale Fire on the merits of its sort of structural innovations or whatever. I just think there's something, and this is something that Nabokov does a lot. He has these sort of hyper-intellectualized characters who have deep emotional things threatening to burst through the veneer of the intellectualism. And that is both in the form and the content of Pale Fire. And Panin is a cute campus novel about a bumbling professor written by a master. So like, Panin's a good book, but I think Pale Fire is a masterpiece. Is that a good argument?
That's a pretty good argument, actually. Yeah, I put more value on the way Panin works as a tale, I suppose. Okay. And I will agree with you that Pale Fire is perhaps the greater accomplishment. I'd much rather reread Panin.
That's interesting, because I mean, It's been a while since I read Penin, and I just read it once as sort of as I was making my way through. And as a tale, I thought it was so-so.
To talk about being an undergraduate and coming across these literary puzzles and working them out, I do think that, you know, somebody like Mark Danielewski, for instance, has a huge fan base among undergraduates who are coming across this kind of experimental stuff for the mm-hmm. first time, and it expands their sense of what the literary is. It's no longer simply mimesis. It's no longer simply representation of the real. They think, oh, I get it. This is a way words can make us think and re-see the world in important ways beyond realist representation. And that for them is very, very exciting because they've never read Joyce and they've never read the history of this kind of writing. So I think that it's a valuable thing, and it might be a moment in a reading life that people go through and then are not interested in it anymore.
It's a gateway drug, apparently, the way Barth was mm-hmm. from yes, the looks
exactly,
of things.
Exactly. I miss that moment. I do, because I recently read Outline by Rachel Cusk, a phenomenal thinky, not much happens realist novel. And I was just super into it. And I've also recently read My Brilliant Friend, the first of the Ferrante mm-hmm. books, mm-hmm. which is so artless in its surface. It's obviously a very artful book below, but the narrator presents it almost with the repetitions that come up, with the way the chapters open. It just seems very, very real. Mm-hmm. And I find myself being drawn toward more and more realism, maybe as I'm maturing or just senescing. And I miss getting excited in that way over the sort of mysterious double talk of some of those postmodern fictions, including the New York trilogy of Paul Auster was one of the books that really got me excited about potentially writing fiction. And it is a book that I will never revisit because I don't think it's not going to hold up for me. I know it's not.
So basically, you want everybody to go out and buy John Barth's collected stories, I think is what you're saying here.
Antoine Wilson, thanks for coming in and helping us to bury John Barth.
Oh, I came not to bury John Barth, but to praise him.
Thanks to Catherine Taylor, Antoine Wilson, Gary Phillips. Our apologies once again to BJ Novak. We ran out of time, but he said he'll come back next week. Our producer and moral conscience, Jerry Gorin. We want to thank Jerry. Our crack production assistant, Ernesto Aureliano. And of course, the irreplaceable Sid Biggs. And we couldn't do this show without the generosity of the Gold Hirsch Foundation. For Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, I'm Seth Greenland. You've been listening to the LARB Radio Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. Tom, do we have more than 2 ratings on iTunes?
No.
Go to your phones, go to your computers. We need ratings. They might cancel us. Who knows? Could that happen?
No.
See you next week.